Hello and welcome to She's the Doctor, the podcast where we hear from women in medicine about their life and career so far. We'll discuss their interests and achievements, but also explore challenges and failures. I'm your host, Dr. Radhika Thakra, an oversharing houseplant-loving pediatric trainee in London. Every week, I'll be interviewing women from a range of backgrounds in a variety of medical specialties and at different points in their career, each with their own story to tell. Dr. Liz O'Riordan is a consultant breast surgeon who was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer in 2015. She is also an author, podcast host, public speaker, hedgehog saver, dressmaker, amongst many other titles. In this episode, we take it back to why Dr. O'Riordan loved surgery and particularly breast surgery. We discuss the challenges she faced as a woman in surgery, and then explore the story of her breast cancer diagnosis and her experience being on the other side of the table, from doctor to patient. Welcome to the podcast, Liz. Thank you so much for coming on. How are you today?
I'm good, and thank you so much for asking me, Radhika. It's great to be able to inspire female doctors of the future.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to start by, if you could just give us a little bit of an introduction about yourself, if that's all right.
Yeah, sure. So I went to medical school in Cardiff in 1993. And I always knew I wanted to be a surgeon. I wanted to be a doctor from when I was a very little girl. I was fascinated by it. My dad was a GP. My mum was a nurse. The minute I walked into an operating theatre, I knew. I was just hooked. It was amazing. And I spent 20 years going through surgical training to end up becoming a consultant breast surgeon in 2013. And it was really hard at the time. There weren't many other female surgeons. It was very much a man's world, and we can talk about what that was like. But I loved being a consultant breast surgeon. It was like general surgeons didn't know what I was doing. How can you spend 4 hours moving fat around inside a breast? But I loved it. And then I got breast cancer myself when I was 40, aged 2015. And then I had a local recurrence in 2018. And that meant I had to retire because my arm didn't work properly, so I couldn't operate. Yeah. And I had no idea what to do with myself. So since that time, I've started writing and talking and finding other ways to help people and educate doctors and patients. And I'm busier now than I ever was.
Wow, that is a really quick summary of such an incredible and adventurous life that you've had so far. Can you take us back to when you decided you actually wanted to pursue a career in surgery? Why have you always loved it? Because I'll be honest, as a pediatric trainee, definitely not my area to specialize in. What was it for you that made you love surgery?
Oh, great question. I think I was always fascinated by the human body and how it worked. Although when I did dissection at GCSE, we had to find the vena cava of a rat and I ripped it out with a fat because I was so clumsy and impatient. It's like, oh my God, I'm meant to be amazing at this and I can't find the main vein in a rat. I walked into the operating theatre. We were allowed to do it as part of our work experience in the sixth form back then. And just being in this room and seeing bowel being lifted out and it wriggling and they're taking a colon cancer out and they're saving someone's life. I want to do that. I think you know whether you're a pyjama wearer or not, whether you want to be in an operating theatre in some form or you don't. And every time I went in, I was just, I need to do this. I was bored beyond belief on medical ward reps, yeah. Spending hours discussing trials and shall we raise the beta blocker by 10 milligrams. I don't care. I want to fix someone. I want to say, talk to someone. Just like when the first time you diagnose appendicitis, they have the history that you hear in the books and the tummy hurts when you press and the blood tests say it is. And you open them up and you see an inflamed appendix and you take it out and they are up and smiling 3 or 4 hours later. It was just, there was nothing else quite like it.
Yeah, I can totally appreciate that. Interestingly, I did my work experience on colorectal surgery as well. And I had that exact moment where I saw them taking out a colon cancer. But I think at that point, I knew I didn't want to do surgery. And I realized I didn't like standing in an operating theater for a long time. But I guess that's what I always say is one of the beauties of medicine is that we all love different things. We all do the same degree and we can subspecialize into so many different things and care for our patients in so many different ways.
Exactly. It's the most amazing. There is a niche for everybody. Yeah. And it's sad that you don't get to experience every speciality before you have to make a decision. So when I was training, we had our first year was medicine and surgery. And then you decided.
Really?
if you wanted to do pediatrics, you'd never done pediatrics as a doctor. You may have done it on a firm like 3 years ago. It was literally medicine and surgery for everybody and then go. At least now there's a bit of leeway to help you try a few more things on. But you don't know what it's like to be, say, a pediatrician until you've done it for a year or two, because your first year, you're a glorified secretary, and it's so hard to think, hang on, and forget about, for me, my first job was pediatric surgery. My first Venflon was in a 36-week-old baby with a pyloric stenosis. Yeah. It's terrifying.
I know.
But I loved it, and I worked with the most amazing team, and I just thought, I have to do this for life. And it's kind of stepping back and thinking, the team are amazing, but it's not the job for me. I think it's really hard to get that awareness of what you want to do when you're 30, 40, 50, 60.
Yeah. Was there ever any point where you considered leaving surgery, or you thought, actually, surgery isn't for
me? Yes, there was. I did most of my training in South Wales. I got my MRCS exam and I couldn't get a job. And at the time, it was all based on points on the CV. Yeah. And if you didn't have research, you couldn't get, we called a number, a registration training job, so a CT program. And I had to take 4 years out to do a PhD that I didn't want to do, purely to get letters after my name so I could then get a job. And I found that really hard, but actually I had a life, because I wasn't working with doctors and I realized there was more to life than talking about medicine. It was actually really good for me. But then my research was in a lab looking at thyroid cancer slides. So I lost all my surgical mentors and I got a job, but it was on the other side of the country. So I moved from Wales to East Anglia, kind of Cambridge, Ipswich, and beyond. Yeah. And it was really hard because I'd forgotten so much. And at the time, most of us were trained negatively. You're told when you've done something bad, not when you've done something well. It's the bullying, the harassment. I used to do it, I'm sure, because that's how I was trained. It's very hard to say, you did that really well, but actually this was dangerous, don't do it again. And for me, as a single woman in her 30s who had moved 400 miles away from all her friends, I was lonely. I had no social life. The long hours, I was writing at my PhD. I used to go out drinking with the juniors, but I can't bollock them the next day if I've been dancing in a nightclub with them. And I thought, I remember sitting down crying in the colorectal nurse's office thinking, I can't take this anymore. You know, you've been on call all weekend, you've worked your ass off, but they just find fault and you're just so tired and I can't take it anymore. You have no idea what the weekend has been like for me. And I said, I'd rather work in M&S stacking shelves and have a social life than carry on, because I'm in my mid-30s, I'm not happy, I have no friends. And I just thought, this, it's not worth it. It's really, really not worth it. And I went to see a medical careers coach to explore what other options were for me. And I cannot do this. I hate my life. The surgery is fine, but I'm not doing it. I'm getting picked on. I don't like this. It was that feeling. I had two cats for company and I thought, I can't be like this for the rest of my life. There were no other women surgeons around me. I wasn't working for female surgeons. It was really, really hard. And then I realized I have a very low risk level. I need to know that I have money coming in to pay the mortgage. I had a house. I don't want to go back to university and retrain to do something else because I have a mortgage. And I don't want to go and work for pharma. And I don't want to go and be a project manager for kind of, you know, all the other companies everyone did. So I kind of thought, well, the minute I'm stuck, because medicine is a guaranteed income, a guaranteed career progression, a good pension. So I kind of thought, well, okay, if something comes up, I will quit, but I'll keep my head down. I made this decision, but it was really hard thinking, I'm quitting, I'm letting everybody down who supported me. And have I just wasted my life going through this? And then my boss asked me out the day I moved hospitals. He was no longer my boss. So I suddenly had a social life and I discovered breast surgery and there's no on call and I could talk to patients. And I thought, actually, this will give me a life because it's purely 8 to 6 work and I can see my patients. I just have to struggle through the last couple of years of surgical training. But I think it's really hard for women because, and again, I know things are changing, we're all very fluid now, but generally men marry women who are the wives who look after them and the house and the children. And when you are single, you are having to be your own wife or your own partner. And it's really, really hard doing it all.
Yeah.
I wanted to start a company called Rent-A-Wife because I just want someone to come home to and cook me tea and make the bed. And I could chat to you when I was brushing my teeth. Then God knows what you get on the internet. But it was just that kind of, I can't look after patients and look after me. Something had to give.
Yeah. And what gave?
I think it was just finding a branch of surgery that would give me a life.
Yeah.
I'm one of those people who are very risk averse. So when someone tells me, just take the colon out, just show me one more time. Just show me one more time. I'm too scared.
Can you watch me?
And when I am pushed, there is sweat dripping down my back and my legs, my scrubs are soaked. I hate this. Whereas other people are like, yeah, I read this last night. Give me a knife, I'll do it. That's not me. And I could do it. I just didn't believe in myself. Huge imposter syndrome. And I hated the on-call. I would be physically sick before I went on call in a major teaching hospital because I was scared I couldn't cope. And because I was the girl who wanted to do breast surgery, the consultants hated being on call with me because I couldn't take a colon out by myself. So it was kind of like this never-ending cycle. And discovering breast surgery would be no on-call. And I didn't need to worry about patients dying and I could talk to them. I thought that gave me a thing I can do that I can help, I can enjoy, I can then have a life outside because I get my weekends and evenings back. And when I started dating my husband, it was like, oh, I have someone to talk to. I have someone to share things with. I'm not going to be going on holiday by myself for the rest of my life. And it was realizing there's more to life than surgery.
Yeah. I didn't realize that breast surgery didn't have any or no on calls.
No on call. Patients don't die. They don't get sick. You may get very rarely you'll get an abscess that does need to go to theatre, but often the general surgeons look after them. It is 4 or 5 clinics a week.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize this. And we'll talk about this now. You don't know what it's like to be a consultant until you are one. And you suddenly are responsible for every patient and every decision your junior doctors make. And when it is your turn to tell someone they have cancer or to tell parents that their son has whatever it is, you absorb their emotion. You suddenly feel that you have broken this family.
Yeah.
And then you do it again, 5 times in the morning and 5 times in the afternoon, every Friday for the next 20 or 30 years, absorbing that. And I had no idea what impact that would have on my mental health. And we don't get counseling. We don't get coaching. No. It's part of the job, but it's blooming hard when you're the boss.
Yeah, it really is. Like even when I do it as a junior, I find it really heavy and it plays on. There are case, like 1 or 2 cases I can think of where I've had to break bad news, particularly when I was working in A&E. And they always play on my mind. I always think of their faces. I always think of their scan results, that family. And you can't let it go. And they probably don't even remember you anymore. I don't know what...
No, they will.
Do you think?
They will. We can talk about how I know that they will. But it's if you have to break bad news or you're in a... And it's what you want to do is get in the room every time it happens.
Yeah.
And it feels uncomfortable. As a student, as a doctor, you are in this very, very private moment. But you need to go in there. You need to look at the body language. What do the nurses do? What does the doctor say? How do you feel? Because you will learn the good and the bad.
Yeah.
I love what that person said. I'm going to write that down. But God, they were awful. And then afterwards, talk to the doctor that broke the news. Talk to the nurses. What happens after? How do you feel? Because I never told my juniors I would go and cry in the toilets when I told a 23-year-old she was dying. We're superhuman. We don't show emotion. But actually saying, I went home and cried after I did that. Are you feeling it? Are you okay?
Yeah.
And saying, I'm struggling with that. How do you cope and learn?
Yeah.
It's so important. You have to look after yourself.
Yeah, that's really true. You were talking about being a woman in surgery during your training and how isolating you found that. How did you manage to cope through that? Or how many other women were there? How did you find it? How did you find the experience? Because that's definitely changing. I'm sure you've seen that too. But how did you find it when you were training?
So when I was an SHO, old money, ST.
I still say SHO.
FY2. I was one of 2 girls on the surgical SHO rotation. I think we're 10 or 13 and I was one of 2. Yeah. And I didn't see a female registrar and I didn't see a female consultant for the whole of my ST training. It was normal because I hadn't seen them as a medical student, but it was very hard for me learning how to act as a woman in a male environment. Before the days of iPhone, so you had to sit and talk to your consultant in the coffee room. And once you've gone through that, what's your CV, what speciality do you want to do? You kind of run out of things. I have no interest in football. And there's a lot of banter in theatre. And I think you need that banter to break the ice so you can deal with the life and death situation you're working on and make it seem less stressful. And there's often a lot of sexual innuendo. And it was very hard to say, do I go along with the dirty jokes? Because I find them funny. And do I make a banter about my sex life to get people off my back? And do I go and drink pints with the lads? And then I'm seen as a lad.
Yeah.
Or do I get offended? And then I'm seen as the prissy, prim woman who's no fun, who he won't talk to. And every year I got older, I kind of found my sense of self. And I learned how to cope. And this is who I am. And I realized it got easier when I was a registrar because there were more surgical registrars. I started working with female consultants who had children, who were normal, and that was fantastic. And suddenly, the bonding you get in the changing room talking to your female boss, you get that extra level of coaching or teaching or training. It was so nice. And I realized for me, the trick was how to cope with the men I was working with. Again, this is before iPhones, was flattery. Pure flattery, because my husband knows I did it. It's part of the reason he started dating me. One of the guys was in a band. So in theatre, I'd ask him about his band set list. Another man was all about the children and someone else was doing hypnotherapy. I would ask them about their lives and they thought I was interested in them. And it was flattery. And they then were nice to me. and I had, for everyone I work with, what can I talk to them about that I know they're interested in? So they'll think I am interested in them and they will give me a break and they'll back off on the juniors. It was fun, almost wrapping them around my finger, and they probably didn't know it at the time, but it was that way of thinking, well, okay, I'm going to work with a lot of people I don't necessarily like. I don't need a reference from them, but I have to get through the next 6 months, 3 years. So if by asking my husband every morning at the time, can I see if your stripy socks match your stripy tie? And then another consultant would come along and say, well, I've got my 50p Tesco socks. And it was just little things to make them feel human and make them feel, just develop that relationship. Yeah. And then that protected me. And I thought, I know who I am and I'm going to show them this side of me today, but they're not going to hurt me. But that took time.
Yeah. And it takes confidence as well.
It's much, much, much better. It does. And that it's like, when you go up a year, you suddenly feel your competence to say, do a lumbar puncture on a kid that you wouldn't have done the day before. But because you're now an ST3, I can do this. It's weird. What happens overnight? I don't know. You suddenly wake up thinking, I can do a lap appendix today because I'm an ST4. It's crazy. And again, moving to a different hospital gives you a chance to try something new, to kind of start again and think, okay, this is me.
Yeah, I hate that move to a new hospital, a new rotation, but then I also find it quite refreshing that actually I can now start again, build new relationships. And I'm learning, because I've been a pediatric trainee for 2 years only, but I'm learning that every time I find the job really hard at the beginning of 6 months, but I know that by the end of it, I know what I'm doing and I really enjoy it. So now I just trust the process and I tell myself, you will be fine by the end of this, and you're going to hate it for like probably 3 months, and then you're going to get better at it. And just learning to trust that and to realize that
it's the extra layer of responsibility you get when you go up a grade, and plus changing hospitals and got the new IT system, or where does this work, and you don't know who the good people to ask for x-rays are, all of that, and you feel out of your depth every single time. So this is funny, I've mainly done colorectal surgery for my first couple of years as a registrar, and then my third year, what you probably call ST5-6, I went to do vascular surgery. And on the first ward round, because the senior guys were off in theatre, it was up to me, and I had 50 patients to see in an hour before theatre, no idea about any of them. I was asking them all, have you opened your bowels today? And was it hard or was it soft? And have you passed wind? And the house officer looked at me and said, you meant to check their pulses. Like, oh my goodness, I didn't know. It's completely scary doing something you've never done, but you will learn. And as you said, it is trusting that process.
So how many years were you a consultant in breast surgery before you were diagnosed with breast cancer? Do you mind telling us a bit more about?
No, not at all. I've talked widely about this. So I was a consultant surgeon in 2013 when I was 38. Mm-hmm. And I actually found my first breast lump back in 2011. I just got engaged. My husband had gone away for 2 months sailing around the Arctic, and I found a lump. And I was howling on the sofa that night, in tears, thinking, it's cancer, I'll be dead in a year, my hair will fall out, my husband will leave me, what's the point? This is the end of the world. Completely histrionic. And my boss knew there was something up the next day, and she managed to get me into the breast clinic by pulling a favour. And it was just a cyst. I had breasts full of cysts. But I went through, I got that fear that women have when they come to see me. In 2014, I'd had another couple of cysts, one on each breast, and I'd had a normal mammogram, a normal scan. And then in June 2015, I had another lump. I just noticed it in my cleavage one morning. Well, it's just a cyst. It looks like all the others. And I'm a breast surgeon. I should know. And I was telling my mum, and she said, look, you just get it checked out. And I said, oh, okay, fine. And I didn't go to the hospital I worked in. I went to a hospital down the road where my husband, who's also a surgeon, worked, just because I didn't want I was embarrassed. My own team didn't know I had a cyst. And she examined me and wasn't sure. Let's get a mammogram. Mammogram was normal. Then they did an ultrasound. And I do ultrasounds myself. I'm nosy. I turned to look at the screen and I saw a cancer. Wow. I was 40. I was healthy. I was a triathlete, no family history. And normally patients get their results drip fed. You have a symptom, you have a test, you have an operation, you get the results. In that split second, I knew it's big, I'm young, I'll need a mastectomy, I'll need chemotherapy. I've got a good idea what my chance of being alive in 5 or 10 years is. And my surgeon came in and she saw the screen. And as they were doing the biopsy, she said, right, think about where you want to be treated. Both of us knew what it was. We didn't need to wait. So I went home and I told my mum, I'll be telling you I've got breast cancer next week. Don't be silly. You'll be fine. No, I know I won't. And I did. And I suddenly realised how little I knew about what it was like to be a patient in the one field I was an expert in.
And then what happened next? How?
So I had, my mammogram showed it was my mammogram was normal. But on the ultrasound, it was 2.5 centimetres. And because they couldn't see it on the mammogram, I had an MRI. Because I'm young, my breasts are very, very dense, so it's hard to see clearly. The mammogram showed it was actually closer to 6 centimetres. How would I, a consultant breast surgeon, not felt that lump in my breast? And so they gave me chemotherapy first to try and shrink it down to avoid having a mastectomy. And the chemotherapy worked. It was horrible. And we can talk about that later, but the chemotherapy worked. It had disappeared. But because I've got quite small breasts, I had a mastectomy and an implant reconstruction. And I remember going in to get the post-op results, and I was expecting good news because I'd seen the scans. It had disappeared. And I remember sitting in that waiting room, looking at all the other couples who are clutching hands, eyes wet with tears, looking at the floor, gearing themselves for bad news. It was the 23rd of December. And I was sat in that room thinking, thank God I never need to be in their position again. And I went in and my surgeon said, two of your nodes were involved and there was 13 centimetres of cancer left in the breast.
My gosh.
I had a mixed cancer of ductal and lobular cancer. And a ductal cancer grows in like a big lump around the ducts in the breast. But lobular cancer grows in sheets, so you can't see it. And I had one of the really unusual ones that wasn't seen on an MRI. And I remember every single detail of that conversation, what I was wearing, what she was wearing, what she said, every single detail. So whenever you break bad news, no matter how tired or hungry or pissed off you are, just take a moment, because that person is going to remember it for the rest of their life. So I then went on to have my lymph nodes removed, and I then had radiotherapy, and I was put on tamoxifen. And that was the first time. And it was about 9 months of treatment.
And how was that? How were those 9 months?
Chemo, it's a bit like having the worst hangover of your life and the worst cold or flu of your life, plus losing your sense of taste and feeling really sick and not being able to think clearly. It was horrid. I can't remember it now. The worst thing for me, I wasn't so bothered about losing my hair. I quite liked being bald after I'd gotten used to it. Losing my eyelashes made me feel like an alien because I couldn't put mascara on anymore and I just felt completely sexless. And again, I had a breast cancer I could feel. It was really weird living with it as it slowly shrank down. The menopause, I thought I wet myself when I woke up having my first night sweat. It came on instantly. Chemotherapy causes brain damage. I couldn't do crosswords anymore. I couldn't think. I lost the feeling in my fingertips. And as a surgeon, there was a risk that could be permanent and I'd never be able to operate again. But it was the constipation.
Oh, really?
Chemo gives you diarrhea or constipation because it attacks every cell in the body that's replicating. But because cancer cells grow more quickly, they die. And it had been 10 days and I hadn't had a poo. And I had bleeding piles and I had awful tummy ache. And I was suddenly, You know, when you're a junior doctor and you're handing out laxatives on the ward and you see the lactulose and the fiber gel, the milk of magnesia, thinking, thank God I never need to drink that stuff. It tastes disgusting.
Yeah.
And there was me having lactulose and fiber gel and Movicol. And after 10 days, crying on the toilet naked in pain, thinking, God, this is horrible. I've lost my pride. I've lost my dignity. It was those moments that just, plus you lose all your body hair. I had no idea as a consultant surgeon, you lost your pubic and your leg hair as well. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And the things that we don't think about as doctors, cancer is so common. We come across it all the time. Mm. But we, as you say, we don't actually have much knowledge of how it is to be a patient. And I guess that's exactly the kind of work you're doing now, which I guess we'll talk about later, but we really don't understand it. How did you find being a patient who was basically a specialist already in the topic? Like, how did you find that?
Chemo was interesting because my oncologist works in the hospital where my husband works. So we were not a normal couple.
No.
And there was a bit of, it's very tempting to rush through consent and information because you assume people know. And if you ever treat someone with medical experience, you need to say, I'm going to treat you like I treat any patient and tell you everything I'd normally tell them. And when I'm finished, we can go into any other detail. Because if you start chopping it, you know, it was anaesthetist. I don't need to talk about anaesthetic, but they've never had an operation before and you will miss things. So I say that I'm going to treat you like a normal patient and then we can move on. It was surgery. Because my surgeon had trained me. She was a friend. She was a mentor. She had trained me. She wasn't sure whether she could treat me. We had to stop being friends so she could dissociate herself. And that was really hard, losing a friend at that time. But I wanted to tell her what implant to use and where to put the scar and where to put the drain, because this is how I did it. And she had to say, stop. You need to be a patient. You need to. And it was my, I guess, a defense mechanism, really. You're just desperate for control and just to think, I need to surrender myself to her. And actually the reality to hit in, I'm about to lose my breast. I have had breast cancer, and be that scared, frightened, vulnerable woman, because I'd been in denial. And it was when they came to get me, my husband had gone off to talk to somebody and they had to get him back. Think, no, I can't go before I see my husband. Gave him a hug and crying. And I was wheeled down the operating room and they left me in the holding bay whilst they got things ready. And it was a team of women I'd worked with who were looking after me. So it was really hard for them to do my operation because I'd worked with them for years when I was working in that hospital. But just in that moment in the holding bay, I just felt it hit me. The emotion of this is real was really, really hard, because you're lying there on this table naked with your gown and your paper hat. And it's theatre is often the one place where we don't introduce ourselves. The hello, my name is, or the badge. Everyone's bustling around doing their thing, like in a busy rhesus.
Yeah.
We don't all say hello to the patient. This is what this person's doing, and this is what this person's doing. I would always make a point in a trauma call of going and looking at the patient and looking into their eyes and saying, I am Liz. This is who I am. This is what I'm doing. There are lots of people doing lots of other things, and that's okay, because it's scary. And I didn't get that, to be on this tiny cold table with people moving around you thinking, what's going to happen?
Yeah, gosh, I can't even imagine being in that situation. Hearing your story is giving me goosebumps. And I think as doctors, we find it really hard to be on the other side. I have such a small example in that I went to A&E on Sunday because I cut my thumb with a knife. And I hated being in that position. I felt so sorry for myself. And I think even more so because I'm so used to being the doctor. So then switching to being the patient, it just felt so unfair. And like, why does this happen to me? How am I going to cannulate my patients? How am I going to do anything at work? And it's just really hard to switch it and then to just take on that patient role and to not try and take control of every little thing, because it's what we're meant to do, especially when you're in a hospital environment. That's what we're trained to do.
And did you ever think, what if they don't do what I want them to
do?
What I think they should do? So you suddenly get what it's like for a patient waiting to see you. And they may have waited 6 months for that appointment and they have questions and the stress, the anxiety. And often what we do as doctors is we barge in.
Yeah.
Nice to see you. Sit down. How are you? I'm going to run through my checklist. Oh, time's up. Any questions? I'm not going to tell you what's wrong with me. I don't want to waste your time. And then you walk away thinking, oh, I won't bother. Mm. I won't ask them. And I think when I went back after my first cancer, I would start by asking patients, what questions have you got for me? Write down a list and let me see, and let's start.
Yeah.
Because then I can help you, because that is a consultation for both of you.
I think that's something I've really learned when going to my parents' healthcare appointments, is that I know how anxious they would be for the appointment or for a blood test result. Yeah. Or my dad would be preparing for a week before with questions for me to write down for when I go with him. I would rearrange shifts so I could go with him to the appointment.
Yeah.
And you go, and honestly, it would always be that. Like, you'd wait for an hour because the clinic's overrunning, which is obviously not in anyone's fault. But then you get there and it's so quick. It's just really hard to be on the other side and realize how much pressure the doctors have on themselves to get through the clinic, to finish on time, yeah, or even finish late. But also, you've been so desperate for this appointment and you need it,
yeah,
and you want that time. It's definitely something that I've always taken with me. And each experience I've had when I've been a patient or been on the patient side, I've kind of tried to take more and more learning of how this can change me as a doctor.
I think going to the hospital is a big thing.
Yeah, we go there every day for work.
Patients have no control over what happens in that appointment. It purely depends on the doctor and how they're feeling and how much time they have and what they say. And it's ridiculous because it's our body. You can tell a hairdresser what you want to have done.
Yeah.
And just try and remember, every single patient is a huge event. They've been waiting and waiting and waiting. And just by asking them, before I start, what questions have you got for me, can help. And you may think, actually, I need to bring you back to give you another appointment, to just say, I'm going to be another hour late, I'm sorry, but this person needs my time. Just remember how stressful it is for you. It's but unless you've been on the other side like you have, you don't get it.
No,
because it's just another clinic. Cup of tea, yeah, fine. How many people got left? Five. Oh my goodness, I'm really running late.
Appointment every 10 minutes, get it
clinic's
done.
Clinic's normal for us. My clinic appointments are 10 minutes, and you never know how many cancers you have, because you don't know what the screening program is going to turn up. And some weeks I'd have five cancers, and I have 10 minutes to tell them what should take an hour. It's never going to keep up to date. It's ridiculous. But it's trying to think, okay, how can I help you?
How else do you think your practice changed when you went back?
So it was really hard for me going back, watching women as I told them they had cancer, because I saw myself, and realizing so many things. So like the words we use, I've seen the best and the worst of breast cancer. And I've heard bosses, and I copy them, telling women, you know, you're lucky we caught it early. It's good that it hasn't spread. Trying to be positive.
Mm-hmm.
But even a 1 millimeter bit of cancer is still the end of the world for that person. And actually, no one's lucky or good. And when you go to break bad news, you are prepared for it. You've been in the MDT, you've gone through the notes, you've got the plan, everything's lined up before you go in. But to the patient, it often comes out blue. And it's sitting on your hands for 10 seconds and letting that news sink in and letting them come up with the most important question. Because when we barge in, oh, it's cancer, and we're going to do a mastectomy, they don't have time to say, who's going to look after my disabled dad? Or what am I going to do about this? That gets shut away and they don't get a chance to say it. So changing the language and giving them time to take in the news and come back, that was really, really important for me. The one thing that really affected how I wanted to help patients, I wanted to be the nurse. I wanted to give them a hug. I wanted to say, yes, this is terrible, I'll get you through this, and I've written a book and I can help. But I have to be the bad guy. And when you are given bad news, you don't give a toss about someone's great aunt who had the same thing. You have to go through I hate the journey word, but you have to go through your own treatment until you're ready to hear other people. But for me, it was the impact of cancer on my life afterwards, the impact of the menopause on my sex life and the importance of exercise. And I'm now legally disabled. How do I get back to work? How do I help patients live when they leave my clinic? And that's what I spend a lot of time trying to focus on. But I was scared to operate because I got post-mastectomy pain syndrome. I live in chronic pain now, and I didn't want to hurt anybody because I knew what damage I might do. And it was really, really hard psychologically dealing with it. And I was, in some ways, it was a relief when my cancer came back and I didn't have to do it anymore.
How long was that you were back at work for?
I was off for a year and a half because it took quite a while to get a phase return to go back to work. I ended up spending 6 months shadowing consultants at a neighbouring hospital because they had to be able to say that I was ethically safe to treat cancer patients having had it.
Yeah.
And was I fit to operate? And was I fit to break bad news? And that was hard work, plus being able to concentrate again after chemo. but I'd had a nodule of scar tissue at the edge of my mastectomy scar. I'd been having physio on for every 2 weeks for a couple of years. I'd got a really bad frozen shoulder. I just thought it was a nodule of scar tissue. I'd had an implant and the radiotherapy had made it contract like a tennis ball and I was getting severe pain. I was planning to go flat. And my surgeon examined the scar tissue and she said, let's just get a scan of this just to be sure. And it showed a 2.5 centimeter local recurrence on my chest wall. I didn't know. And I'm a consultant breast surgeon. And that was 2.5 years later in 2018. And then I had to go flat for a completely different reason. And I remember walking around my local department store in tears because I've got very small breasts. There aren't many mastectomy bras for women of my size. And they're very full cut to have a prosthetic in. So thinking of all my low cut clothes, thinking I'm going to be living in turtlenecks, but I can't wear turtlenecks because I'm sweating every minute with a menopause. And just how am I going to disguise it? What am I going to do? It's come back locally. There's a much higher chance it could come back properly and kill me. Also, local recurrence is so rare. There are no trials. So having been in a job that is driven by science and trials, there was nothing I could read. And that was really, really, really hard. And a side effect of all the treatment to my armpit meant that I couldn't use my left arm properly, which is why I had to retire. But psychologically, I couldn't deal with it. I'm still, it can come back. I can't deal with this. I can't see another woman with metastatic cancer because I just see me in her place. So it was a relief. And actually, although losing my career through the one disease I spent my life training to treat is completely ironic, I realized I was boring and sad and lonely because my life was just surgery. And even though I was married to my husband and I had a dog and a nice life here, I didn't have any hobbies. I didn't do anything for fun. It was all surgery. And I am more fulfilled and happier and fitter now, 5 years on, as a retired lady. Well, I'm not a lady who lunches, but I can help far more people by putting videos on Instagram than the 100 women I would treat a year. And it's made me realize there is more to life. And to anybody listening to this, you need to make sure that you look after yourself. You don't take on too much. You tell your boss, I can't do that paper because I won't finish it. I've got these other projects. Your life is important. Teach your trainers that I'm not going to work at the weekend because that's my time. Block it into a diary and say, no, this is my time for doing whatever I want, whether it's binge watching Netflix or whatever it is that you do for you. I wish I'd done it, but I didn't. That fear of this job, exam, audit, paper, say yes to everything.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. Most papers you collect data on never happen because you do all the data work and then the registrar takes it, but then they move jobs and they never finish it. I used to have 5 or 6 projects on the go. Oh, did the email bounce? It's 2 o'clock in the morning. Oh my goodness, I better do it. I would now say you have 2 projects on the go, whatever they are, audits, papers, research. One, you are collecting data on with blood from the registrar consultant saying, if I do this work, please tell me it will come to something or you're not going to bugger off and leave it alone. And the second one is when you're finishing writing up. If the professor of Harvard asks you to start another study, you say, no, I do not have time at the moment. I will not finish it. And I do not want to let you down. I'll be finishing my next project in a month. So come back to me then. And as a consultant, I'd much rather a junior said, sorry, I don't have time. Find someone else or ask this person because they're desperate for a project.
Yeah.
Then that, oh, yes, yes, yes. It's never going to happen.
That's something I'm learning too. Just say no, because it's better for both of you.
You have to say, what is in this for me? Is something really going to come out of this? Or is this just a tick box audit, which I have to do? Fair enough.
Can I just ask, going back to when you realized you wouldn't be able to work anymore.
Yeah.
How did you find that? Like, you'd spent 20 years, you said, working towards your career. And then this happens, and then you try to go back to it, and then you then have your recurrence. Mm. How did you find actually saying, I can't do this anymore? You said it was a relief at the time. Is that the only feeling you felt, or was there more to it?
So I'll take you back. I hadn't told my colleagues at work. I'd had the biopsy, and the biopsy sank, so I had a good idea that it was cancer. And I was going to find out the results on a Thursday, and I had a list on a Wednesday. I had a locum registrar with me who I'd never met, who wasn't doing things the way I wanted. And I was snapping and I felt awful because I'm never angry in theatre, but yeah. I know I was snapping at him. It was a wire guided case in a very fatty breast that was melting. It wasn't my best work. And I do not know how I got through that list. I should not have done it because my head was on other things. And then I rang in sick the next day and I never went back.
Really?
No, because I started treatment. So I rang in, I got the results that day. So I rang in sick and said, my cancer's come back. I'm going to be starting treatment. There was no way I could treat breast cancer patients knowing I had a recurrence. It wouldn't have been ethically safe for me or them.
No, of course.
So I found out the results. I said, right, I'm having more treatment. And that was more surgery and then more radiotherapy. And then I had my ovaries removed. And then I realized that my left arm didn't work properly. So I couldn't get it up to operate. And then I had to go through ill health retirement. And it's a long process to prove that you can't do your job to get a little bit of money.
Yeah.
And when it came through and I was officially retired on ill health, I thought I'd be relieved. Because I didn't have to treat breast cancer patients anymore because I was still living in fear of my own recurrence. But God, I grieved. I couldn't really properly remember the last operation I'd done. And I wonder if I'd known it was going to be my last operation, like someone who does, who'd normally retire, would I have done anything differently? Would I remember that moment? For me, it was realizing I'm never going to scrub up again.
Yeah.
That was my, I'm never going to be in a room full of people working together to do something. That sense of camaraderie that, okay, here we go. That was great. We did a great job. I'm never going to get that again. And I can't remember the last operation. And I know my last operation wasn't my finest moment because I was about to find out my cancer had come back. That sense of not being able to talk to people and to help them. All I've ever wanted to do since I was 7 is to help people, and suddenly I can't. And who am I? And how do I define myself if I'm not a surgeon? What do I do? And how long do I have left of my life? So the average life expectancy of a metastatic cancer patient is 3 years. So I thought, well, okay, I don't have metastatic cancer now, which means I've got 3 years. I can't plan any further ahead than that because I don't know whether I'll be here. It was just that. It wasn't necessarily the actual job. It was being in a group. I was incredibly lucky to work with some amazing people in theatre. That sense of, I'm not going to get that again. And it's funny, I went back to do a video for Nuffield Trust, who were, they're sensibly offering massages to cancer patients without you needing a letter, which is just ridiculous. And they wanted to do a little VT of me. And we went into their operating theatre and got me to scrub up. And it was heartbreaking. I thought, I miss this. So COVID was great because I could now wash my hands properly. It's like, yay, we have to scrub up properly. I love this. I'll pretend I'm back in theatre. It was really hard. Really. And not having a reason to get up in the morning.
So how did you move on from that? And can you tell us a bit more about the work you do now?
Yeah. So when I was going back to work the first time, I started writing a book with Professor Tricia Greenhouse. I bought 10 books by breast cancer patients, and I'm a breast cancer surgeon, and she bought another 10, and we are both medical experts because we wanted to find out what it was like for patients. And we started, I have never been on a breast cancer forum. I didn't realize that social media cancer internet existed. I never looked, it wasn't my job, I didn't need to. Patients asked questions like, does radiotherapy make me radioactive? And is it safe to have sex after chemo because I'm scared I will make my husband's hair fall out? You do not remember anything you are told when you find out it's cancer. And you go home and your husband says, what did the doctor say? I don't know. I can't remember. Go on the internet. So we wrote a book to answer every question we'd had, to take people through the whole thing. So promoting the book and writing helped. And I'd written a blog all the way through. And that led to me being asked to talk about my experiences. So talking to 7-year-old boys, to breast cancer patients, to the heads of private health companies, just trying to improve patient care. And I hate that people will listen to me because I'm a doctor and a patient. It's very hard for patients to get their voices heard.
Yeah.
And then that led to me doing more writing. And in the last year, I've gone onto Instagram and now just doing little videos just to help answer the questions patients have. And it's another way of helping people and getting that. I like being stroked. I like someone to say, well done, thank you. Because I don't get that now. I'm not a doctor. And now I can help people all over the world understand what's happening to them. And it's really fulfilling. But the problem is, I can spend all day on my phone. And I have to realize the millions of strangers I'm helping are strangers. And I don't owe them an immediate response because you feel guilty. And it's actually, these 3 days are for me. And people can wait for a reply. And it's very hard when you are, I guess, trying to help everybody. It's where do you learn to help yourself? And that's something I struggle with.
How do you do it? What kind of things do you do to help?
I kind of fall in a heap every couple of months when my diary gets so full. I almost wish my cancer would come back so I could cancel everything. It's like, no. But you get it's messages from people desperate for help. And can you do this? And could you have a look? And I love helping people, but I realize I've got to do my own projects first. Yeah. I have to block out a half a day. I need a morning a day to do my exercise, to walk the dog, to do the shopping. And it's blocking out my time and saying, right, I have, say, Wednesday afternoons and my slot for doing work for other people, and blocking that in. And if someone asks me, I can do that, but I'm not free until October.
That's a really good way of doing it.
And actually, so someone, a consultant said, when she has, you have an SPA time, so free sessions. Say, well, okay, I'm going to block it out. Say, I'm doing this for you. You ask me, I'm not free for 3 weeks. I'm not free for 6 weeks. If you can't wait, go to someone else. Because I will say yes to everything, and then, oh my goodness, it's Sunday, I've not done it, and the emails come in. And it's really hard with all the social media requests, how to manage them, and it's something I'm learning. You do what you can.
But it's just like being a doctor. If you're not looking after yourself, how can you carry on making the content you do and helping other people? You can't.
I did not look after myself as a single registrar. I lived off bagels and cereal. I couldn't be bothered to cook for myself. It was M&S food from the garage on the way home. I joined a gym and never went because I was busy.
Sounds like me.
I didn't exercise, bad sleep. I was really, really unhealthy. I drank too much. Most doctors are. And it's really hard to find the time to say, I go into work at 7:30. I come home at 7:00. I've got the audit to do. I don't have time to exercise. I'm going to grab food. It's really, 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 really hard. Do the best you can on the days off that you have. But it's just thinking, our health is really important and we don't talk about it enough. You know,
no.
The patient, you get bleeped for a patient that hasn't peed for 4 hours, but you've not peed for 10 hours. And actually saying to the nurses, I need 15 minutes to go and sit and eat and recharge. Otherwise, I'm used. And take that time because you are patients yourself. And I know how hard it is, but actually, you've got to look after yourself.
That's one of my biggest pieces of advice when people ask me for advice for new F1s is, even if it's 10 minutes, make sure you have your lunch, because say you're working in A&E, a patient will wait 10 minutes, but your efficiency will be so much slower.
Yeah, you get slower and slower. You're less efficient.
The more advanced you get into your training, you realize how much of a difference looking after yourself makes. I used to sleep 5 or 6 hours when I was an F1 and go to work. I could not do that now. That would be torture to myself to do that now. And I don't know why I did it, but you just realize that how much more enjoyable life is when you just look after yourself even a tiny bit, or how much more bearable your day at work is, even the hard days, if you just give yourself 5 minutes to have a cup of tea and some biscuits after a difficult, well, for me right now, or neonates after a difficult delivery. I'll just say, actually, I just need to go and have a cup of tea in 5 minutes and I'll come back. And we need to do that, otherwise we can't sustain in the kind of careers that we're in.
And what you may find is the more senior you get, you will tell your juniors to do that, but you won't do it yourself. White lies to the nurses, because they don't know where you are. I'm sorry, I'm with a really sick patient. That sick patient is you. They don't need to know that. You tell a male boss, sorry, I've just got my period, can I go? And you know, sorry, I've got to go and sort myself out. Oh, they don't need to know that you are looking after yourself. And it's awful, 5 minutes to grab a Mars bar. We should have our lunch breaks. You can't. Remember, the work never stops.
It doesn't.
The work never stops. And if you are dealing with someone who's sick, and there are three nurses saying come now, but a gunshot injury comes into A&E, they will find people to come and help. You can only be in one place at one time, and sometimes that's you.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you will get burned out and exhausted. And again, I've driven home and not known how I've got home.
Yeah, I've done that so many times, especially after night shift.
I've gone far too fast, thinking the quicker I get home, the safer I am. That was how tired I was, and it's dangerous, and never do, but you do.
Yeah.
We have to teach people, right? So the best job I had, it was amazing. It's house officer, and we worked in a hospital in Cardiff called Llan Doc that has one of the longest corridors. It felt like a mile long, and we had patients all the way along it. Start the war round at 9 o'clock in the morning, and at 11:30, when we got to the middle, we would all go down to the canteen, we would all stop for tea and donuts, and then we would carry on.
That's so
nice. I did orthopedics in the middle of a 100-patient fracture clinic. Again, they would stop at 11 o'clock. The guy got the canteen to bring down bacon sandwiches. All the juniors from the ward would come down. You will sit with us for 20 minutes whilst we all have a break and talk about what's going on, not about work, but who we all are. And then you go back buzzing. Think about looking after the people around you and lead by example.
That's actually one thing I've really enjoyed about the rotation I'm on at the moment, is that there are normally at least 4 or 5 SHOs in every day, even on a weekend, even on a bank holiday. Brilliant. And it's so nice to see each other, to catch up, to know how each other are doing. And it just makes work feel that little bit more enjoyable, because you're almost seeing your friends every day, even though they're colleagues. They become your friends. And it makes things so much more fun, because you're not alone. And I know that some parts of, especially medical training, it can be very isolating, and surgical training. But that is one thing I love about pediatrics, is that often you're with a few other people, and it helps. And I think, it helps make it feel less lonely.
Hugely.
I think we have kind of touched on this, so I think I might know what you might say, but is there one piece of advice that you would give to a younger version of yourself, or something you wish you knew when you were younger and has changed how you think about things now?
Oh my goodness. There are so many. And it's me as a person.
You can give me more than
me
one.
Me as a person, or me as a doctor. I think, so when I was a house officer, I was planning to be Wales' first female trauma surgeon, married with 3 kids at the age of 27. Because there were no female surgeons or no trauma surgeons. That, right, I'm going to do this. It'll be really, really easy. Life happens, and what you want at 20 isn't what you want at 30, and life changes, the people you meet change. There is no right time to get married, there is no right time to have children, you don't wait for the right job. And I think it's realizing that you don't know what's around the corner, you can only do the best you can, and if you don't make it to the top, it doesn't matter, the ladder can stop. I think accepting that your goals move as life changes, and you can become a very different person, and that is okay. And then to look after myself, to prioritize myself, my own health, my own friends, my own social life, because you need that to cling to. A, to have days where you don't talk about medicine. But just that self-care. Go to the gym, eat the fruit. But I think it's realizing you can say no. It is all right to say no. And the bosses may not like it, but that's their problem. You'll work with another boss. You need to teach your bosses. What's their social life? What are they doing outside of work? I think it's just, you don't know what's going to happen, and that's okay.
Yeah. And actually, on that point, what are the other things that you do outside of your work? The first time I followed you on Twitter was actually from one of your clothes that you've made.
Sewing.
I think I came across that, and that's when I followed you. So what are the other things that you do? You make clothes.
I do. So I'm going to quit surgery counselling. She gave me a workbook, and on it was a thing called the Wheel of Life, which I can put a link to. And basically, you divide your life up into 7 or 8 sections. So school, work, learning, fun, family and friends, charity, health, spirituality, religion, all the different factors that make up someone's life. And if you imagine the center of the wheel is 0 and the outside of the wheel is 10, you mark where you are, how happy you are, how fulfilled you are. So I hated work, but I was doing work. I had money, although I didn't open the bank bills because the money you spend on books and courses were ridiculous. I had no friends outside of medicine. I didn't do anything for fun because I was working. I wasn't looking after myself. I gave about £10 to charity. I was really, really unbalanced. And I did that again. And I realized I need to make all the other bits of my life better. So for fun, I started making my own clothes, a bit like being a surgeon. Plus, there's so many cheap clothes made that go into landfill. I thought, I want to make something I love that fits my new shape that I will wear forever. Although I realised fabric costs a fortune, so I'm not actually saving money, but shush, don't tell my husband. And then charity. I volunteer at park runs, and I volunteer every week at a hedgehog shelter run by a couple in the 70s. I found a hedgehog outside in the day, which means they're poorly, and I took it to the local shelter. And there are these couple in the 70s who look after 200 or 300 hedgehogs. They feed and wash and change them twice a day. They look after them until they're heavy enough to be released in the winter. So once a week, I go and I give my time. I do get to play with baby hedgehogs in the winter, but I give in my time for free, expecting nothing back. And it's that sense of fulfillment. And I will read a book for fun, and I will go off and cycle up mountains. But it's actually, I had depression twice as a surgeon, and everyone says, go and do something you're passionate about. And I didn't know what that was because I had no hobbies. And it's really hard, but just taking that time to think, gardening, planting flowers, making clothes, baking bread, We've just got a pizza oven, so that's the latest thing I'm going to tackle.
Oh, nice.
There's so much you can do. It's just giving yourself the time to do it.
Well, Liz, thank you so much for today.
Have you got time for one final thing?
Absolutely, please.
So I wrote my memoir about my life as a female surgeon getting breast cancer back in 2020, and I just launched a crowdfunding campaign with Unbound because publishers said the world doesn't need another medical memoir, and I think they're wrong. Plus, there are no memoirs by female general surgeons. So by the time this comes out, it should be fully funded, but you can pre-order a copy. And my publishers have got a discount code for anyone listening, which is She's the Doctor 10. I will give that to you that you can put in the show notes so you can go and pre-order a copy of my book, which should come out early next year.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much for organising that. And I will definitely order it. Thank you so much. Lizzie, yeah, I've really loved speaking to you today. You are such an inspiration. You make me feel empowered to know that even if life doesn't go to plan, or even if something drastic in my life happens, I will be able to get through it.
You will.
And I feel really inspired talking to you. I've really, really loved it.
You're going to make me cry.
Honestly, it has been absolutely lovely. Yeah, so, so great. Thank you so much for coming on. I'll leave links to your Twitter and Instagram and website and your book and the code all in the show notes. But I'm really, really grateful. Thanks so much, Liz.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Radhika.